That evening, after dinner, all the family remained in the refectory. Sarah stood behind Tom's chair with one arm draped over his shoulder. At intervals, she rubbed the mosquito bites on his bald pate. When she did that, he closed his eyes in quiet enjoyment. At the other end of the table, Dorian sat with Mansa on one side of him and his hooker on the other. Verity had never looked upon herself as a domesticated creature, but since her arrival at Fort Auspice, she had found a deep satisfaction in homemaking and caring for Mansur. She and Louisa, who were so different in nearly every way, had taken to each other from their first meeting. Now they moved quietly around the big room, clearing away the dinner dishes, serving endless cups of coffee to their menfolk, or coming to sit close to them and listen to their talk, from time to time adding their own opinions to the conversation. Louisa was well occupied with Master George. This was the time of day that they all enjoyed most. "Tell me about Beshwayo," Dorian ordered Jim, and he laughed. "Ha! You have not forgotten!" He picked up his son from the floor and placed him comfortably in his lap. "You have raised enough hell for one day, my boy. Now I'm going to tell a story," he said.
"Story!"
said George, and subsided at once. He laid his golden curls against Jim's shoulder and thrust his thumb into his mouth. "After you and Mansur sailed away in the Revenge and the Sprite, Louisa and I loaded up our wagons and set off into the wilderness to look for elephant and try to make contact with the tribes so that we could open trade with them." "Jim makes it sound as though I went willingly," Louisa protested. "Oh, come on now, Hedgehog, be honest. You've been bitten by the wonder bug as deeply as I have." Jim smiled. "But let me go on. I knew that there were many large war parties of Nguni coming down with their herds from the north." "How did you discover that?" Dorian demanded. "Nkunzi told me, and I sent Bakat out far northwards to read the sign." "Bakat I know well, of course, but Nkunzi? I only vaguely remember the name." "Then let me remind you, Uncle. Nkunzi was Queen Manatasi's chief herdsman. When I captured her cattle, he came with me rather than be parted from his beloved animals."
"Oh, of course. How could I ever forget it, Jim boy? Wonderful story."
"Nkunzi and Bakat guided us into the hinterland to find the other rampaging tribes of Nguni. Some were hostile and dangerous as nests of poisonous cobras or man-eating lions. We had a few scrapes with them, I can tell you. Then we came across Beshwayo."
"Where did you find him?"
"About 200 leagues northwest of here," Jim explained. "He was bringing his tribe and all their cattle down to the escarpment. Our meeting was most propitious. I had just come upon 3 big elephant bulls. I did not know that Beshwayo was spying upon us from a nearby hilltop. He had never seen mounted men or a musket before. For me, it was a most fortunate hunt. I was able to drive the elephant out of the thick forest into the open grassland. There I rode them down one after the other, with Bakat loading and passing me the guns. I managed to kill all 3 within a 2-mile gallop on Drumfire. From his lookout, Beshwayo watched it all. Afterwards he told me that it had been his intention to attack the wagons and massacre us all, but having seen the way I shot and rode, he decided against it. He's a forthright rascal, is King Beshwayo."
"He's a terrifying monster of a man," Louisa corrected him. "That is why he and Jim get along so well together."
"Not true," Jim chuckled. "It was not I who won over him. It was Louisa. He had never seen hair like hers or anything to match this cub to whom she had just given birth. Beshwayo loves cattle and sons." They both looked down fondly at the child in his arms. George had not been able to stay the course. The comforting warmth of his father's body and the sound of his voice was always a powerful soporific, and he had fallen into a deep sleep.
By this time I'd learned enough of the Nguni language from Nkunzi to be able to converse with Beshwayo. Once he had changed his warlike intentions and prevented his warriors attacking the wagons, he set up his kraal close to us, and we camped together for several weeks. I showed him the delights of cloth, glass beads, mirrors, and the usual trifles of trade. These he enjoyed, but he was wary of our horses. Try as I might, I could not prevail on him to mount one. Beshwayo is fearless, except when invited to take part in equestrian activity. However, he was fascinated by the power of gunpowder, and I was required to demonstrate it to him at every opportunity, as if he needed further convincing after watching the elephant hunt. Louisa tried to lift George out of his father's arms and take him to his bed, but as she touched him, he came fully awake and let out a bellow of protest. It took some minutes and the reassurances of the entire family to quieten him again, to the point where Jim could resume his tale. As we came to know each other better, Beshwayo confided in me that he was having his differences with another Nguni tribe called the Amahin. These were a cunning, unscrupulous bunch of rogues who had committed the unforgivable sin of stealing several hundred of Beshwayo's cattle. This sin was compounded by the fact that in the process they had murdered a dozen or so of his herd boys, of whom two were his sons. Beshwayo had not yet been able to avenge his sons and recover his cattle, because the Amahin were ensconced in an impregnable natural fortress, which the erosion of the ages had carved from the sheer wall of the escarpment face. Beshwayo offered me 200 head of prime cattle if I would assist him to assault the fortress of the Amahin. I told him that, as I now looked upon him as my friend, I would be pleased to fight alongside him without payment. "No payment except the exclusive right of trade with his tribe," Louisa smiled softly, "and a right to hunt ivory through all the king's domain, and a treaty of alliance in perpetuity." "Perhaps I should have said little payment, rather than none at all," Jim admitted. "But let's not be pedantic. I took Small Boy and Muntu and the rest of my fellows, and we rode with Beshwayo to the lair of the Amahin. I discovered that it was a massif of rock detached from the main escarpment and secured on all sides by sheer cliffs. The only avenue of approach was across a bridge of rock so narrow that it would allow the passage of only 4 men at a time. It was overlooked by the Amahin from the higher ground on the far side, and they were able to shower rocks, stones, and poisoned arrows on any attackers who attempted to force the passage. Some 100 or so of Beshwayo's men had perished already, shot with poisoned arrows or their skulls crushed by rocks. I found a place on the face of the main escarpment from which my fellows were able to fire upon the defenders. The Amahin proved a doughty lot. Our musket balls served to dampen their ardour a little, but did not prevent them sweeping the attackers off the exposed bridgeway as soon as they ventured onto it. "I'm certain that at this stage you conceived the solution to the insoluble, great military genius that you are," Mansur laughed, and Jim grinned back at him. "Not so, cuz. I was at my wit's end. So naturally I did what we all do in these cases. I sent for my wife." All three women applauded this gem of wisdom with such merry laughter that George was startled awake again and added his voice to the uproar. Louisa picked him up, helped him find his thumb, and he collapsed back into oblivion. I had never heard of a Roman testudo until Louisa explained it. She had read of it in Livy. Although many of Beshwayo's men carried shields of rawhide, their use was frowned upon by the king as unmanly. Each warrior fights as an individual and not as part of a formation, and in the moment of greatest danger he is wont to throw aside his shield and hurl himself unprotected upon his enemy, relying on the fury of his charge and his fearsome aspect to drive his enemy from the field and carry him through unscathed. Beshwayo was at first appalled by such cowardly tactics as we suggested. In his view, only women hid behind shields. However, he was desperate to avenge his sons and retrieve his stolen cattle. His men learned swiftly how to overlap their shields and hold them above their heads to form the tortoise shell of protection. My men kept up a lively fire on the Amahin, and under their testudo, Beshwayo's impis charged across the bridge. Soon as they had a foothold on the far side, we galloped across on the horses, firing from the saddle. The Amahin had never seen a horse before, nor had they faced cavalry. But by now they had learned of the power of our firearms. They broke at our first charge. Those Amahin warriors who did not leap from the cliffs voluntarily were helped to do so by Beshwayo's. You will be pleased to know that the Amahin women did no jumping. They stayed with their children, and most found husbands among Beshwayo's men soon after the end of the battle, Louisa assured Sarah and Verity. Sensible creatures, said Sarah, and stroked Tom's head. I would have done the same. Tom winked at Jim. "Take no notice of your mother. She's a good heart. The only pity is that it does not match her tongue. Go on with the story, lad. I've heard it before, but it's a good one."
"It was a rewarding day for all those who took part," Jim resumed, "except the Amaheen warriors. Apart from a score of cattle that the Amaheen had killed and feasted upon, we recovered the rest of the stolen herd, and the king was delighted. He and I shared millet beer from the same pot, but only after we had diluted it with our commingled blood. We are now brothers of the warrior blood. My enemies are his enemies."
"Having heard that account, there is no doubt in my mind that I should leave the defence of the swamps between here and the Umgeni River to you and your blood brother Bishwayo," Dorian told him.
"And God help Herminius Kurtz when he tries to find his way through."
"Just as soon as the wagons are made ready, I shall leave to find Bishwayo and enlist his support, and that of his spearmen," Jim agreed.
"I hope, husband, that you do not intend to leave me here while you wander off into the blue yet again?"
Louisa asked sweetly.
"How can you think so poorly of me? Besides, I would meet with a cold welcome at the kraal of Bishwayo if I did not have you and Georgie with me."
Bakat went out into the hills to summon Inkunzi. The chief herder and his helpers wandered at large with the cattle herds, and no one else would have been able to find him as readily as the little bushman. In the meantime, Small Boy greased the wheel hubs of the wagons and brought in the draft oxen. Within 5 days, Inkunzi had come into the fort with 24 Nguni warriors, and they were ready to leave. The rest of the family stood on the palisade and watched the wagon train head for the hills. Louisa and Jim rode ahead on Trueheart and Drumfire. George was tucked into the leather carrying sling on his father's back. He waved one chubby little arm at them.
"Bye-bye, Grandpa! Bye-bye, Grandmama! Bye, Uncle Dowie! Bye, Manny and Whippity!"
he sang out, and his curls danced and sparkled to Drumfire's easy canter.
"Don't cry, Grandma. Georgie still come back soon."
"You heard your grandson," said Tom gruffly. "Stop blubbering, woman."
"I'm doing no such thing," Sarah snapped. "A midge flew into my eye, that's all."